in celebration of the inaugural Popeye's Bahamas Bowl game, we've bought a two-piece dinner for each one of y'all this evening. We're just going to go ahead and roll right into episode 13. How you feel about that?
Man, I'm feeling great. So Kojak left us off in a real good spot. He ended his interview and got to talking a little bit about the college playoffs, being a Florida State fan. How do you become a Florida State fan?
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that one out. I mean, maybe he said he's been a fan since back in the day, so maybe Charlie Ward, you know, the late 90s turned him onto the Seminoles, the Criminals.
Yeah, but at any rate, Kojak left us off in a good spot, so we're going to get into some college playoff talk. But before that, I wanted to get into some NFL playoff talk, because we got the playoffs are looming on the horizon. Everybody's played about 13 or 14 games at this point. So just starting off, we just wrapped on the Thursday night game where you got Arizona going to 11-3, so they're in control there.
Arizona's looked so bad as of late, too. I don't know. I mean, did you watch any of that game?
I did not.
I listened to a little bit on the radio, and when I read the recap afterwards, it was pretty much a field goals contest. And, I mean, I really expected the Rams to rise up and beat the Cardinals, because they've been playing. They played terrible against the Falcons, and they looked awful. I don't remember who their last matchup was, but they looked terrible in that matchup as well. And I figured they were still on the slide, you know, taken up with the... we're going to cut all this out, because I don't know where the fuck I'm going with this. How about that?
So you got, yeah, Arizona moving to 11-3. Let's just go into the NFC since we're there with the Cardinals. So they are their division leader at 11-3. The other divisional leaders, you've got the Green Bay Packers and then the NFC North. You got the Philadelphia Eagles at 9-4 in the NFC East. And then you have the mighty, mighty Atlanta Falcons holding down as kings of the NFC South at an astonishing 5-8 mark. So they are currently winning that division and will make the playoffs and will host a game most likely as a, 7-9 team.
That's ridiculous. You know, it's just like the Atlanta team to go ahead and limp right into the playoffs. You know, harkening back to the Atlanta Hawks' last decade's worth of playoff runs. You know, sub-500 team. I'd really just rather have us lose out and get a better draft pick, personally.
I agree. If we make the playoffs, and at this point, I mean, we're kind of might as well, unless they just intend to, you know, tank out. If we make it to the playoffs, we're going to pick into the early 20s, which does nothing to help our rebuilding project. We still need help on both lines. You know, the offensive line still needs a little bit of work. The defensive line still needs somebody to cause some pressure on the QB. So, personally, yeah, I agree. I would rather the Falcons not make the playoffs. But at this rate, as bad as the South is, they are going to make the playoffs. They are in the driver's seat, and they might just go ahead and drive that thing all the way into hosting a first-round playoff game.
We're going to drive the bus right into a terrible draft pick. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. So while we're while we're talking about the NFC, still the other your other wild card teams as of right now, the Seahawks will be in at 9-4, and the Lions will be in at 9-4. That will leave the Cowboys just out of the playoffs. They're also 9-4, but they've got some work ahead of them. They've got that big Monday night matchup that they've pretty much got to win. I think the loser of that game is essentially out of the playoff run.
Exactly, which is a shame because, two 9-4 teams are battling for the right to make the playoffs while the Falcons are going to... They're looking like they're a lock to limp in at 5-8.
Yeah, it's embarrassing. So,
who do you got in the AFC, though?
Well, in the AFC, it's hard to go against the Patriots. We left them for dead 4 weeks. I'm sorry, not 4 weeks ago. In week four.
Man, I don't know. If you run the time back, you know, listen to the podcast, I'm pretty sure we were not on the bandwagon of the Patriots are done. We were expecting them to rebound.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And we'll review the game tape. But I think that we were a little less pessimistic than most. Let's just say that neither one of us would have waved Tom Brady off of our fantasy football rosters, let alone write off the team that has owned the AFC East Division for the better part of 10-plus years now.
You know who was ready to wave him on his playoff team and said that he would, or not playoff, but fantasy team, and who would wave him on his fantasy team?
Who's that?
None other than TMR Matthew Berry. That's right. Fantasy Football Now, Fantasy Football Focus podcast. He said he would waive Tom Brady back in week 4.
Well, you know, he looked bad in week 4, but you just can't, you know, it's just one of those things, man. You just can't write the guy off. I mean, it's they're too well coached and they're too smart of a team. I mean, look at what they did in the late 90s with receivers, you know, they just pulled from the street and just basically ran out there, and they got the job done there. So it doesn't surprise me whatsoever that they're, you know, they've rounded on the form. They're leading the AFC East at 10-3. The Broncos take care of the West at 10-3 as well. The Colts own the North currently at 9-4. And the Bengals... Are the Bengals in the South? Might need to cut that out.
The Bengals are in the North.
The Bengals, okay, so the Colts are in the North. I'm sorry, the South. And the Bengals are in the North. The Bengals are 8-4-1. Your current wild card teams are the Steelers and Chargers, both at 8-5. First team out right now is the Ravens, also holding an 8-5 record.
So I think way back when I had said I like Denver from the AFC, and I was really hot on Arizona and Detroit in the NFC, but I don't remember who I said to make the playoffs. But my early season pick, the New York Giants, to win the NFC East was a terrible one.
Well, I think, to be fair, they've got a new offensive coordinator. They're switching out their scheme there. They went to a West Coast type of passing game. So it really is, I mean, it came back to haunt them. You know, they obviously weren't able to hit the ground running. Odell Beckham, you know, is showing that he is, a fantastic, you know, pickup for them. You know, a lot of people are saying that might have been easily the catch of the year, maybe the best catch ever, when he had that one-handed, you know, sideline grab.
Yeah, that was ridiculous.
I mean, and realistically, I think he grabbed that with like 3 fingers on the ball. I mean, the dude just... Yeah, it was impressive. It was an athletic feat.
Man, that looked like that Powerade commercial with Megatron. Remember that? Was that Megatron where he caught the ball and then caught the ball with one-handed, caught the other ball one-handed, and then caught the third ball with both balls in each hand? Like he sandwiched. He made a ball sandwich. Not that Calvin Johnson likes ball sandwiches. Moving along.
Hey, you're talking about meatball sandwiches.
Right, meatball hoagie, actually.
There you go. So, I mean, as far as the playoffs go, I mean, I went vanilla, you know, with my thoughts on that. I figured the Broncos were too loaded, you know, still offensively, and then they signed every major defensive free agent under the sun. Right. So it was hard to go against them. So I liked them coming out of the AFC. And then as far as the NFC goes, I want to say I like the Packers. I did not like the Seahawks just because I am a firm believer in the Super Bowl hangover. They looked like they were done midway through the season, but they're rounding into form now. So.
They're looking all right now. They might be getting hot at the right time.
Yeah, they're looking like a playoff team. They're looking like, you know, they got their identity back. They're doing, you know, they're doing what they need to do. They're leading off with a strong run game. The defense is showing up, and I mean that's always a winning combination. But I don't know if anybody's gonna be able to handle Green Bay. They're looking just as dangerous as ever. Aaron Rodgers is looking great.
Aaron Rodgers is playing out of his mind. It seemed like after he told the crowd to relax, he was like, you know what, relax, just let me handle biz, and he's done exactly that. They've won, I want to say, 9 out of their last 11 games.
Yeah, they're on some kind of ridiculous run. Right,
because didn't they go 0-2 to start the season?
I'll look it up real quick.
Man, but yeah, the Falcons just about pulled that off, though. What was that? Thursday, or no, it was Monday night. Monday night game. We were pretty much one onside kick away. I mean, I had full faith in Matty Fat Sacks that night. It was looking like if we got the ball back on an onside kick, we were going to put it in the end zone and win that game.
Yeah, that was another a heartbreaking loss. I was listening to that. I was listening to that game on the radio as I was driving around, you know, coming home from work, and I tuned it out once they were up. Once Green Bay was up by 3 scores, and like we talked about online, I'm glad that I tuned it out because I saved myself from the heartache of realizing that they came back within 1 score. And like you said, one onside kick recovery away from, you know, looking like they were going to go ahead and, you know, storm down the field and score the, you know, game-tying, you know, score.
You know who looked really good that game, though?
Who's that?
Brady Lacy.
That's everybody, right. Another guy that, you know, people thought were just, you know, wasn't going to do all that great, but he's looking very much legit. great compliment, you know, to the rest of that offense. I mean, they've got a great group of receivers, and then to have a power guy like Eddie Lacy there, I mean, that's, you know, pick your poison, you know?
So I'm going to stick with the Detroit Lions. You know, Arizona is somehow still getting it done with Drew Stanton, but he just went out with a knee injury. They said he sprained his knee, so he will most likely be returning this season. But they're going to march out Ryan Lindley.
He sounded like a kicker to me.
Yeah, you know, San Diego State University, Ryan Lindley. I had no idea who he was until I looked him up, to tell you the truth.
Big shout out to the San Diego State Aztecs. Great alum from there, Mr. Marshall Faulk.
That's right. That's right. Greatest show on turf. But yeah, I'm going to go Lions from the NFC wild card way into the playoffs. And I'm going to go with the Broncos beating the Patriots.
So you're telling me you like the Lions AFC. To go to the Super Bowl?
I do. It's a bold call, but
that really is. But you know, it's one of those things, man, that the Lions, they have so many weapons on offense that you just wonder at some point in time, they're just going to get hot and they're just going to score 50 on everybody.
Exactly. And they're 9-4 right now. And Calvin Johnson missed 3 games.
Yeah, it's I don't think I would be that bold. Like I said, I still like the Packers. I think when you get into that playoff situation, you it's hard to argue against that team. They're going to be able to run the ball effectively, and they're sure as hell going to be able to throw the ball if they, you know, when they need to.
Exactly.
I think the Cardinals are a fraud. They're not going to be able to make it. They're going to get into the playoffs without a doubt, but I don't think they're going to, you know, win more than maybe their opening round matchup. That's it. I mean, you can't do that with a third string quarterback. And even if they get the second string guy, Drew Stanton is not going to. He's not exactly, you know, instilling faith, at least in me.
Right. So it's safe to say that Megatron Meatball Sandwich will be in full form for the playoffs. And I think he actually officially missed 2 games, but he literally played like 7 snaps in that 3rd game. So I count that as a miss. And I know this because he was on my fantasy football team and he laid 3 eggs for me in a row. Pissed me off quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a tough pill to swallow there. It's like my dynasty team with the aging Andre Johnson. I think I have J.J. Watt on that team, and J.J. Watt has scored more touchdowns still than Andre Johnson has.
I'm pretty sure J.J. Watt has outscored Andre Johnson on that team for the last 3 years in a row.
Yeah, he pretty has. Sure. So far this year, Watt is the third leading scorer on that team, behind the likes of Phillip Rivers and Randall Cobb.
Nice, nice. So moving along, though, who do you have in the college football playoffs?
Okay, so college football. Let's preface it by saying, so we got the inaugural BCS playoffs coming in. So your top 4 teams, just to recap, you got Alabama at number 1. You've got Oregon at number 2. You've got, who's number 3? Ohio State at 3. And then you've got Florida State at 4. So I can't argue against Alabama. That team's loaded, and it's not even a good team, but there's so much talent on that roster. It's going to be hard to beat them heads up, you know, in one game.
We've seen much better iterations of the Alabama team in the past. Julio Jones's team, for example, even last year's team, I would argue, is better
last
than this year's
team. Was great, yeah.
But yeah, I have full confidence in Alabama beating the pants off of Ohio State and their third string quarterback, and then rolling right through Oregon in the final.
So you like Oregon to beat Florida State then?
I do, only because I don't think Jameis ekes by this one. I think Oregon is going to put up about a 20 to 24 point lead by the half, and Jameis is going to make a valiant comeback. But in the end, it's not going to be enough, and Oregon rolls into the natty.
Now, here's a scenario that I want to propose to you. Let's say Oregon gets the ball first. And let's say they don't go 3 and out. But what if they have to punt on their first possession? And then Alabama, even if they score a field goal, what I'm getting at is, what if Oregon doesn't get off to their typical, you know, positive start, where they, you know, score a touchdown, they get, you know, a couple touchdowns early, and then start just, you know, systematically just wearing down teams because the other team is having to press a little bit? Because I don't think they're going to be able to do that necessarily against Florida State. I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Florida State's defense, but just like with Alabama, it's That's probably going to be one of the more talented teams as far as overall ability that Oregon has faced. And as much as I hate the, you know, as much as I doubt that Florida State can keep their run going, all they've done is won every single close game that they've been in. I mean, it's that team of destiny feel with them.
That's true, and I agree. The caliber of athlete that Oregon is going to find themselves up against is far greater than the competition that they've had all year, and it's not even close. The high schools that are in Florida that 80% of them wind up going to University of Florida or FSU, they're far, far more athletically talented than anything that's, you know, Oregon doesn't even really recruit.
They coach them up, you know, and they do that really well. They coach up their guys. They get a guy like Marcus Mariota, who's going to win the Heisman tomorrow, by the way.
Oh, that's a lot.
You know, that's a done deal. He was recruited by one other college coming out of high school, and that was the mighty, mighty Memphis Tigers. That was it. It was Memphis and Oregon, and that was it.
I can't even think of a Memphis Tiger other than DeJuan Wagner right now.
There you go.
He played basketball.
And he dropped 100 in basketball.
That's right. I was going to say the only reason I know the name is because he dropped a century.
Didn't I think Derrick Rose played over there too. But, you know,
that's right. That's
neither
right.
of these guys play football. So that makes our point perfectly. To be fair, the reason I think one of the reasons that Mariota wasn't heavily recruited is that a lot of recruiters are actually swayed away from recruiting in Hawaii just because there's not a whole lot of overall. You're not going to get a lot of productivity out of taking a recruiting trip to to Hawaii. There's not a lot of overall talent. You're better off going into, like, say, a hotbed like California, like Texas, like Georgia, like Florida. Those areas where you can, within a 100-mile radius, you can probably visit more than a couple hands full of top flight high school recruits.
If you're spending the money to send your recruiting agent to Hawaii, you're hoping to land the one Troy Polamalu or Marcus Mariota at that time. You know, and Polamalu played at USC.
Right.
He was Hawaii, though. Did he go to high school in Hawaii?
I don't know if he went to high school there, or if he went to school somewhere in California. But no, you're making the point perfectly there. There's just not a lot of talent that's going there, and also most of that talent, the big name talent that's recognizable, a lot of them do end up going to USC or some other California school. It's just kind of the pipeline for kids that come out of the Hawaiian Islands.
Here I was thinking that Polamalu was Hawaiian. I apologize. He was born in Garden Grove, California.
Man,
how about that?
He had me fooled.
Me too.
He's a phony.
So I think it's safe to say that we're in agreement that Alabama beats Ohio State.
I believe so. There's no way that, again, third-string quarterback, much like Arizona, going to be tough sledding against a quality opponent. And I watched some of the SEC championship game, and it got embarrassing when Alabama just continued to just run the ball right at Missouri. And I think that's going to be the formula that they use going through these playoffs. I mean, when you got a guy like TJ Yeldon, and then you got a guy like Derrick Henry, I mean, that's just a brutal combination. Oh, and don't forget, when you play action, you got a decent receiver in Amari Cooper, you know, streaking down the field.
You know, Heisman finalist, no big deal.
Yeah, no big deal there. So, you know, do what you will, but that's a tough team to match up against.
Speaking of Heisman finalists, we're pretty much in agreement that Mariota's got this locked down. We had already discussed that earlier, didn't we?
We did discuss that, but the other two players that were invited, Amari Cooper, one of the other two, and then I'm blanking on the guy's name.
Gordon.
Melvin Gordon. So between those two, it's not even a competition. I mean, I think Mariota's going to run away with it. I think the big question is going to be, will he win the Heisman with the highest percentage of votes of all time? The current clubhouse leader in that category is Mr. Troy Smith out of Ohio State. He won the vote, or I'm sorry, he won the Heisman with a total point percentage of 91.63%. Now, Reggie Bush did win by a higher margin, but he vacated that Heisman after he was deemed ineligible.
As a result of accepting a home and an Escalade, right?
Yeah, no big deal. You know, easily hidden from prying eyes by the NCAA. But yeah, I think that's going to be the only intrigue tomorrow, Saturday the 13th, as to whether or not Mariota will win with a higher margin than Troy Smith.
And that's a shame that we're only discussing margin of victory, because I honestly felt like Todd Gurley had a chance to win the Heisman, even coming back from suspension, had he not torn his ACL.
I agree. He would have been another good vote. Before he got suspended, I think he was leading the way. I mean, he was just dominating a class of opponent that was better than what Oregon was facing at the time and traditionally faces. So I think he would have been a very close competitor to Mariota. I mean, Gordon has put up ridiculous numbers too. I mean, he had that 400-yard game
in three quarters.
but it's not a whole lot of there wasn't a whole lot of flash behind all that, other than the humongous video game numbers he put up.
Exactly. Well, speaking of Todd Gurley, we have another special guest for y'all this evening. We actually were proud to welcome for the first time Mr. Peacock to the podcast. He is also a purveyor of all things Atlanta sports related, and he owns and operates Mr. Peacock Square Plays. Y'all should check that out on YouTube. So without further ado, we've got Mr. Peacock himself on the line. Go ahead and introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about, give us your resume, so to speak, who you're a fan of. Let's just go college football, Major League Baseball for right now, and how long you've been a fan.
Well, so, I live in Atlanta, and I'm definitely a fan of the local teams here. University of Georgia, as far as football and baseball, I follow both of those programs very closely. I have season tickets for both of those, and go to absolutely as many games as I can. Professionally, big fan of the Atlanta Braves. As a matter of fact, I actually just bought season tickets for 2015 Atlanta Braves baseball the other day, so I'm really excited about that as well.
Nice.
Got all 81 home games, which I will not be attending all of those or even, half of them, but I do have tickets for all of them. So
you went ahead and pulled the trigger on that deal, huh? We were talking about that when we were in Florida for Georgia-Florida weekend.
I know, and it was just, that was an itch that I had that I just, I couldn't scratch it hard enough until I actually just, bought the tickets. But I actually see it as an arbitrage opportunity, and I've worked things out to where I know exactly what I need to sell these things for on StubHub, and if I can sell... I don't want to get into all the specifics. This is probably not very interesting, but if I can sell X number of these on StubHub for Y amount, then I'll basically have about 20 games that I can go to just for free, and still actually make a little bit of money on the season ticket investment. So that's kind of the way that I'm treating that.
Yeah, and I think that's really, as far as season tickets go, I think that's the most logical way, to go about it. Unless you have all the disposable income and the free time, I just can't see, attending, that many games. Like, we've got guys in our at work that have, like, they go, part on, like, Blazers season tickets, and they just divvy up the tickets for whatever games they want to try to go to. So that works out for them as well.
Yeah, my thinking is that I'm going to go to a lot of games, I'm sure. I'm sure I'm going to use these a lot, but it's not very difficult for me to get down to the stadium, and it's not very costly either. I can just do that on public transportation. The biggest kind of drawback with me is just the availability of beer at the stadium. And I feel like if I'm down there, there's always going to be that temptation to have, four or five cold ones while I'm sitting there watching the ball game. And then, that turns into a lot of money and a lot of calories and whatnot also. So, that's the one thing that I'm a little bit skeptical about.
Oh, the pitfalls of Major League Baseball.
I know that's right.
But anyway, so what I really wanted to dig into this evening is a little bit of talk about Todd Gurley. He's really been a hot subject on the FCK podcast. We've really had a lot of discussions at length about the suspension and whatnot. How do you feel he did? I just sent TJ the article, Mr. Peacock. I forwarded him the article from Grantland that ran right as the suspension happened. And basically, the summation of the article to me was the paragraph that states that Gurley's already established himself as the most surefire prospect since Trent Richardson at the running back position. And sure, he might miss out on the Heisman, but he preserves himself from a year's worth of injury by not coming back. Well, this was before he suffered the ACL injury, of course, but how do you feel this bodes for his future as an NFL prospect?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think any time a guy tears his ACL, it's going to be difficult. And, you know, it's going to kind of put him behind the eight, especially when he tore it. I mean, it was, you know, it was pretty deep into November. It was on the 15th. So it's going to put him behind the eight ball a little bit as far as the combine and, you know, pre-draft workouts and things like that. But the good news, though, is that they have pushed the draft back a little bit. And, you know, they pushed the they pushed a lot of the pre-draft workouts and stuff back a little bit as well, you know. So, I mean, I think if this happened a couple years ago when they were still holding the draft in April, it would have been in early April, I think it would have been a little bit more difficult. But it doesn't, I mean, it's not like it helps them, but I don't think that it necessarily hurts them all that badly. You know, I think that the running back position has really kind of been devalued a little bit in the NFL draft anyway. You know, I think that's pretty obvious if you look at past drafts. And I think that Todd Gurley was going to go in the first round, but he was going to go late in the first round. And honestly, I still think he's going to go late in the first round, even with the injury.
Yeah, and I think that I know that it's not, maybe not so much at the running back position, but you see a lot of other positions, like at quarterback, for example, where a lot of the players, the top prospects, won't even do a full, you know, full amount of the drills and stuff at the combine. Like, they'll wait for their pro day, or they'll skip it entirely, you know, to kind of preserve their stock and just trade off of how they did, you know, with you know, what you could see off of game tape, you know, from, you know, from their seasons at the college level. So I don't know that it's going to hurt Gurley as much as it might have, like you said, in years past. And I think even with the injury, he's probably still the best prospect coming out.
I would agree with that. I mean, I think that he has a skill set that's is pretty obvious if you look at the tape. And I don't think that it's necessarily going somewhere or going anywhere with a repaired ACL. And I think that skill set is in very high demand. It's funny, though, actually. I was thinking about this earlier today. And if you remember last season in 2013, Zach Mettenberger tore his ACL in LSU's last regular season game when they were playing Arkansas. And that really put Mettenberger behind the eight ball because, I mean, he really only started for 2 years. They kind of sheltered him in LSU's offense that first year. There wasn't a whole lot of tape there, and it was really imperative that he be able to do all the combine stuff and all the pro day stuff just to really establish what his skill set was. And then he wasn't able to do that, and he slipped pretty far in the draft. I mean, I don't think it's inconceivable that a guy like Mettenberger with his talent could have gone in the first or the second round if he had been able to do all of the pre-draft type stuff. But, you know, when he tore his ACL and he wasn't able to do that, it really set him back. But I think that there's enough tape out there on Gurley, and I think that everybody knows what he is well enough now to where it's not going to hurt him nearly as badly as it hurt a guy like Mettenberger.
So, speaking of Zach Mettenberger, shout out to Oconee County High School. He went...
Absolutely.
That's right. He went number 178 overall, went to the Tennessee Titans. But what I wanted to mention, take the opportunity to mention, was, did you see J.J. Watt take a selfie after he sacked Zach Mettenberger for the second time? What was that, week 9?
I did see that, and that was one of the best pieces of trash talk, I think, that, you know, really I can remember outside of, you know, a certain Atlanta Braves third baseman naming his own son after a stadium in which he performed really well. So, you know, there's trash talk, and then there's just, you know, taking it to that next level. And I think what J.J. Watt did was definitely qualified for going to that next level.
Yeah, I think the fact that getting back to the draft and what Mettenberger wasn't able to do, I think that definitely that really hammers home that point that it's got to be one or the other. You know, if you have the tape you know, coming out of college, you don't necessarily have to. You're probably just doing yourself harm, especially if you're going to be throwing like at the combine. Like that's the big taboo thing to do. I think Manziel was the only guy, if anybody, last year out of the quarterbacks that actually threw at the combine. Everybody else opts for the pro day where they have your receivers. They've got scripted, you know, routes, and it's in a comfort, you know, in a comfort zone. You know, compared to throwing to random receivers at the combine. I mean, it just doesn't. I think the combine is good for getting like all the measurables out of the way and maybe doing like some of the bench press, you know, reps and things like that. But beyond that, I don't think that it's. I don't think it's a good idea, you know, for a lot of these skill position, you know, players to, you know, to run those more specific drills. With relative strangers, you know. I mean, granted, that's what you're going to go into at the pro level, but you know, I think it kind of puts you behind the eight ball a bit.
Yeah, I'll agree with that, and I certainly see the logic in that. I just think that with a guy like Matt, as many physical tools as he had, but as you know, relatively little actual you know game staff that he took in college, My thinking was that guy needed to take advantage of every single opportunity he had to get out there and throw the football and to show his arm off in front of people, you know. And, I mean, we'll never know now, obviously, because it's come and gone. But, you know, I really think he would have thrown. I think he would have taken every throw he could have gotten at the NFL Combine, you know, if he got that chance. I think he was one of those guys that he really needed to take that risk, so to speak.
Absolutely. I'm going to steer us back to the Gurley course here. I wanted to mention a sign that we had seen. I took a picture of it on the way into the stadium. It was a UGA fan holding up a picture of Eric Cartman. And we actually ran the clip on a previous episode of the FCK podcast. But it was questioning how you get away without paying your student athletes. And for those of you listening to the podcast, you can't see my air quotes there. But I did quote unquote that. How do you feel about the NCAA's punishment that they doled out for, what was it, $3,000 in the end? They thought it was $400, but they wound up...
They settled on a figure of $3,000. Later on, the video that was taken from the backseat of the car showing like 80-some-odd pieces of memorabilia being signed, so I think they just ballparked it at, $3,000.
Yeah, I don't know all the specifics that really went into UGA's investigation, and the NCAA's ultimate ruling was based on the findings that UGA reported, and it's pretty obvious to me that UGA did a thorough investigation. But to the question at hand, I mean, I think that it's completely immoral to try to disallow somebody from selling a piece of property that he owns, as was the case with A.J. Green back in 2010, or from profiting off of its own signature, which was the case of Todd Gurley this year. And I understand the rationale with the NCAA that they don't want to create a situation where boosters can get to these guys or whomever else and put potentially tens of thousands of dollars into their pocket under the guise of signing an autograph. But I would argue that if somebody is that desirous of giving a person tens of thousands of dollars, they're going to do that anyway. I mean, regardless of whether the person signed something or not. So I don't really think that the NCAA's rule is curtailing anything. And as I say, I just think that it's at the end of the day, it's immoral to try to disallow somebody from doing those things if they're still going to be part of your organization. There's no other arena in which a requirement like that would actually fly.
Yeah, and I think it's just so hypocritical. I mean, for universities to disallow that or to punish, you know, players for, you know, making money off of their own likeness. Yet you had the, you know, EA Sports, you know, making football games every year up until this year. You have jerseys being sold at in campus locations with the player likeness. I mean, there's plenty of profiting going on for it seems like everybody involved with the football player or with the athlete, except for the athlete themselves. I mean, I think to me that's what really irritates me about the whole situation.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, the day that Todd Gurley got suspended, you could go to the University of Georgia bookstore and buy a game-worn number 3 jersey that had the nameplate removed from the back of it. But, I mean, come on. There's only one player that's worn number 3 with the new style jersey anyway, with the new number font. And you could go into the bookstore and buy that game-worn jersey for $139. And that goes directly to the University of Georgia. I mean, but the only reason that that number 3, or the primary reason that that number 3 is popular, is because Todd Gurley is the person that wore that jersey. And, you know, I think that the best solution would be for the schools to actually start for the schools to set up basically an auction for autographs, for signed memorabilia, and for game-worn merchandise. Set up an auction, let people bid on these things, and then just split it right down the middle, whatever the proceeds are with the player. And I think if you do that, you basically reward both entities. I mean, you know, it's not like UGA has just exploited Todd Gurley completely through this whole thing, and that's something that kind of gets lost in this whole debate too. UGA has given him a free education, they've given him free housing, and more importantly, as far as Todd is concerned, they've given him access to world-class strength and training, and they've given him a stage on which to demonstrate his ability. And they haven't asked for $1 from Gurley for any of that. So, I mean, I think that it's been a mutually beneficial relationship between the university and between Todd Gurley. And when it comes to merchandising or likeness or things like that, I wouldn't have any problem at all if the school and if Gurley, in his example, could just split the proceeds from those things right down the middle. And I think that if you were to enact something like that that was administered by the school, that would cut out a lot of these douchebag types like this Brian Allen guy. And, you know, there's I don't want to call it a black market, and I don't want to, you know, cast aspersions or anything, but I mean, I think that these are people that you wouldn't really want to associate with a lot, guys like Brian Allen and people that are in that autograph game. And I think that if you set up a system, an auction system through the school like that, and had it administered by the school, you could put some money in these athletes' pockets, and then you could also cut out that nefarious element as well.
Absolutely. I would agree wholeheartedly with your assessment, and especially the last point that you made there is the fact gets overlooked that UGA provides that platform for which Todd Gurley will showcase his talent for the entire nation to see, and then earn himself, you know, millions upon millions of guaranteed money coming out of college, you know, whether or not he takes advantage of the other, you know, the education. He's for sure going to take advantage of the free housing and the other fringe benefits of being a student athlete and a local celebrity at that. I wanted to change. Did you have anything else to say on the subject?
I think we could talk about this ad nauseum. I think there's all sorts of other angles. Excuse me, that we could cover. One interesting thing that we could chime in on, and of course this is always one of those, one of the arguments that will be raised when you talk about paying athletes is in, you talk about Title IX. You know, you want it, and everybody wants to get a piece, and everybody wants to get, everybody will want to stick their hand out, you know, if you start paying, you know, certain players or certain sports.
Right, but you could essentially, I mean, you incentivize greater performance. I mean, how many equestrian jerseys are going to sell, you know, versus a Todd Gurley, for example? You know, like, you incentivize, it's already incentivized to the maximum. You know, football is the cash cow for all collegiate athletics. That's the sport that's most, I mean, we could go into, I think we had discussed offline about how soccer will never be big in America because we incentivize the other spectator sports far greater. So I think it's still unfair, even if you're divvying it up amongst all athletes, because football players have that distinct advantage.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those situations where I think, honestly, it's just, you're not going to be able to play fair across the board with everything, so you're just going to have to pick and choose your spots. I mean, at the end of the day, universities, like you mentioned, that football programs, for the most part, are funding the vast majority of all of the other athletic teams at any given university. So it's not as if those players in those sports aren't already benefiting from, say, a great, you know, football team. So in a sense, I mean, they're already getting benefits from a good football program or a good basketball program.
I agree with that, and I think one thing, too, to keep in mind about the plan that I proposed, I'm not suggesting that you just limit that to football and men's basketball. I mean, you could, there may not be a lot of demand for this, but, I mean, you could set up a similar auction-type thing for women's volleyball, equestrian, swimming, and diving. I mean, just all the sports across the board, and then basically just let the market sort out what they're willing to pay for likeness. I mean, and at the end of the day, that seems to me to be the most fair way to do it. And I think, and I'm not a legal expert on this, obviously, but I think that that would be completely compliant with Title IX, I think. I wanted to point out one other thing about Todd Gurley, if I could, kind of going back to, you know, UGA and the things that UGA has done for Gurley. This is one thing that gets overlooked a little bit and is not mentioned in the Grantland article. Although in Grantland's defense, this wasn't really widely known at the time that he wrote the article. UGA purchased an insurance policy for Todd Gurley that contains up to $10 million in coverage for just this year, and it would pay Gurley $5 million if an injury caused him to drop out of, or excuse me, it will pay him up to $5 million. It will pay him $5 million if an injury caused him to not be drafted at all. And it will pay him up to an additional $5 million if an injury caused him to slip outside of the first round. So essentially what UGA did was purchase an insurance policy for Todd Gurley that would ensure that Todd Gurley is ultimately compensated as a first-round draft pick. So I think that that undermines extremely the idea that Gurley was taking some tremendous financial risk in playing football this year. At the end of the day, when he took the field against Auburn, he was guaranteed of being paid as a first-round pick by May of next year. So, I mean, and UGA absolutely did not have to do that, but they did anyway. And so I think that that undermines a lot of the claims that Gurley was taking some unnecessary risk by playing. And I think that you can make the argument that Todd Gurley was taking actually a smaller risk when he played against Auburn than everybody else that played in that game, assuming that nobody else in the game had an insurance policy that big, and I can't imagine that anybody else did.
Yeah, and I remember I saw that a report on that, and they had actually doubled, I want to say, the insurance coverage. So that was an interesting part, and the fact that the university was the one that footed the bill for that was interesting, because it's not a practice that was uncommon. I mean, you had guys like Matt Leinart, you know, or Reggie Bush, you know, back in the, you know, the late 90s that had similar insurance policies on, you know, on you know, various you know, whether it be their arm or their legs or whatever you know, parts of their body that are presumably going to, you know, to make them all these millions of dollars. But I mean, for me, this is the first time that I had seen a university foot the bill on that, on an insurance policy like that. And I actually wondered if that was something that was gonna be you know, like one of those improper benefits, because not every athlete is going to get that. I mean, granted, they can provide that for every athlete, but you know full and well they're not offering insurance policies of that level. I mean, to even all of the stars on the football team, like you said, I don't think Aaron Murray had, well, who knows? Yeah, I wouldn't think that somebody else, you know, would have a similar insurance policy, even if they were a similar star as Todd Gurley was on the football team.
Right, right. And some of the rumors, and, you know, you have to take things like this with a grain of salt, obviously, but some of the rumors out there are that was one of the conditions for Todd Gurley agreeing to seek reinstatement from the NCAA, was that the University of Georgia would double that insurance policy. And, I mean, if so, that was a very shrewd move by Gurley and by his attorney. But that is some of the conjecture out there, though, right now, is that had UGA not done that Gurley may not have even asked for reinstatement, you know, following his suspension. And, you know, you can't really fault him, honestly, if he didn't. But, I mean, at that time, my understanding was that the policy was $2.5 million and $5 million, as opposed to $5 and $10 million that he has now. But I mean, you know, overall, I agree, and I think that you're only going to see more of this going forward, because there is so much money. involved in it at the next level. There's so much money being made at the college level by everybody but the players. And it's just a faster and more violent game now than it was. And, I mean, I think that the injury risk now, especially to a running back that's going to go out there and carry 30 times, is greater than it was even 10 years ago. I don't have any hard statistics to back that up, but I mean, I know what I see on Saturday, and I don't see any way that that's not the case.
Absolutely, I agree 100%. And I'd like to also add in that the risk becomes greater when the reward at the end of the collegiate career is, you know, has grown exponentially. You know, it's ridiculous at this point. Stafford was guaranteed, what was it, $42 million coming out of college when he signed his rookie deal with the Lions. He was guaranteed a ton of money. So, you know, that exponentially raises the risk there as well. So wanted to go ahead and at this juncture give you an opportunity to plug the Mr. Peacock Square Plays, if you wanted to give that a shout out.
Well, I've actually concluded that for the year. I decided not to do a bowl game edition this year. So I shot the finale on Friday. Went 6-2 over the last 2 weeks. So I was really happy about that. Georgia Tech kind of backdoored me a little bit. I had Florida State -4. That was the only game that I missed last week. But I had a really, really rough September, but I'm proud to say, though, that I rebounded. I had a couple of really good weeks in October and a couple of really good weeks in November to close it out. So, you know, it's been fun. Picking games against the number is difficult. It requires a lot of skill. I would argue that it requires some skills that I may not possess entirely, but I had a great time doing it anyway. So, I'm pretty much done with that this year, and unfortunately, an awful September caused me to finish under 500. So if you bet with me the entire year, you lost money, which I'm not very amused about. But that's the reality. I got to wear that.
Well, I would like to go on record as saying, by you know, I speak for myself and the legion of UGA fans in saying that Georgia Tech backdoored all of us there. And what was your final record on the year?
Gosh, I think it was 26-35. I think. That's pretty bad.
Hey, man, but here's the thing. There's millions of guys, maybe not millions, but at least hundreds of thousands of guys that make a career out of doing what you do, and they're betting that they can be 51%. So, hey, you know, you're well on your way, that's for sure.
Well, I just think it's amusing. You know, I'm driving around listening to sports radio and stuff, and you always hear these talent services that advertise. You know, like, I mean, it's obviously during football season, but so it just makes these claims like, you know, Jonathan Stone is 62-1-1 against the spread in the month of September. It's like, no, he's not. I mean, there's no way that anybody's picking him that well. You know, I mean, I think that any good handicapper, I think, is probably really happy if he can get, notice I said he, if he can get to 70% or 75%. But I mean, I think that's pretty much the legitimate ceiling there. You know.
I think one of these days I'm going to call one of those betting lines on a disposable phone just so I can check it out and to make sure that they can't actually track me down and keep bugging me, you know, week after week.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's the thing, because they always, you know, because I have called those numbers before, and it's always, you know, hey, man, we're really busy right now. Just leave me your number. I'll get back with you in 5 minutes, you know, and so they'll call you back in 5 minutes and tell you what game to take, and then they'll call you back 40 times after that to try to get you to sign up. And, you know, they'll insult your financial status. They do that to me a lot. They tell me how poor I am, you know, and stuff like that. Like, so, okay, yeah, go ahead and insult me. That'll make me spend money with you, but that's, you know, that's their tactic.
Sounds like a pretty classy group of individuals. Really appreciate having you on, and hopefully we can do this again in the near future.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, I would love to just, you know, I mean, as much as I like talking about Georgia football, I mean, you know, we can sit here and talk Braves baseball as long as you want to. I mean, because I'm really excited about that. I got a lot of things to say about that Jason Hayward trade also.
Yeah, and I think that it's definitely something that's, it's even got me, like, as a more of a peripheral fan interested, because there's been so much movement in the front office. There's been so much restructuring and, you know, kind of retooling just with the scouting department and overall talent evaluation. It's got even me excited as far as what the prospects will be going into, you know, 2017, that they open up the new ballpark, and you know, how the that opening day roster will look, regardless of how things may look going into 2015.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I mean, you know, I think they're, I really think right now the roster actually looks decent going into 15. I mean, it's not something that you look at and say, you know, we're going to win a World Series with this group, but I think we're going to pitch real well. I think the chemistry will be a little bit better, and, you know, I think they're obviously going to cut down on some of the strikeouts too, you know, and that's a big thing. And, you know, as far as the front office moves, I keep telling myself, you're not going to be a Major League Baseball general manager if you can't stand in front of people and talk and answer questions intelligently off the cuff and inspire confidence in others. And that's just kind of a requirement of the job. But that said, every time I've heard John Hart talk about anything, he has really inspired a lot of confidence in me. I mean, he just comes across as a guy that really, really, really knows what he's doing. I mean, more so than Frank Wren did. And I'm really excited to see the direction of this thing over the next couple of years.
You know, a quick thing on John Hart. I read this this article talking about when he was early into his Cleveland Indian days, when they had the big off season where they signed Dennis Martinez as a starting pitcher and then Eddie Murray as their first baseman and DH. The sell job that he did to both of them, from what the article said, was that when they entertained Martinez, he said that the wind always blew in, you know, at the ballpark. And then later on, when they entertained Eddie Murray, he was saying the exact opposite, that the wind always blows out. So, I mean, he definitely does seem like the kind of guy that kind of knows his way around. He knows what he's doing, and you know, he's got that little bit of extra, you know, kind of ingenuity, I guess you could call it, to kind of help get the job done.
Yeah, and I mean, his track record speaks for itself. I mean, he built a powerhouse in Cleveland. He built a powerhouse in Texas, and I don't have any reason to believe he can't do that here.
So the Braves just recently traded Jason Hayward in a shake-em-up maneuver. I really feel like it's gearing us more towards the future to welcome in the new regime. It's kind of like clearing out the old, not even old, but clearing out space for future maneuvers, and knowing that we couldn't keep the young core together. It was either keep Hayward or keep Freeman, in my eyes. And honestly, I'd rather have Freddie Freeman. That's just me. What's your take on it?
Well, I mean, honestly, between the two players, I would rather have Jason Hayward, but they locked up Freeman to an 8-year extension last year, last fall. It was about 12 months ago, actually. So they tried to, as I understand it, they tried to do the same with Jason Hayward. They couldn't quite reach a deal with him, and so they signed him to a 2-year deal. So he was going to be hitting free agency after the 15th season anyway, and I believe that the thinking was that Atlanta just was not going to be able to re-sign him once he hit free agency in 2015. John Hart's made some references to Hayward's agent, Casey Close, as being a very difficult guy to work with and to negotiate with. And I think that the Braves, and I think that they're completely justified in thinking this, I think that they just believed that there was no way that financially they were going to be able to make it work with Hayward long term. So with 1 year left on his contract, you know, I think you have to make a move, as much as people who understand baseball really hated to see it. I think that you had to do it. And, you know, the other thing too that's worth pointing out is, I mean, at the time that they made the Hayward trade, they only had three guys in the starting rotation for the 2015 season. You didn't have anybody at the minor league level who's ready to step up and become a starter. So, I mean, it was imperative that you add a frontline Major League Baseball capable starting pitcher somewhere in the offseason. And the Hayward trade afforded them the ability to do that. It got them a really good pitcher in Shelby Miller. And, you know, that's a guy that's under control until 2019 also. So when you look at it that way, I mean, financially it makes a lot of sense, not only for beyond 2015, but for right now.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing is from everything that I'd been reading, they basically offered, you know, a similar contract as they offered, you know, Freeman, and I think Hayward ended up wanting a little bit more. So, you know, I think that the decision was made there. I think from a salary standpoint, I think the decision was also partially made because of a couple of the horrendous contracts that were doled out. I mean, you've got B.J. Upton, who's got a terrible amount of money still left on his deal. And then you've got Dan Uggla, who's no longer with the team, who's still on the books, I think, for just next year. So, I mean, financially, there's just no way that the Braves are going to be able to do that unless the ownership group was willing to foot the bill on that. And clearly they weren't. I mean, they haven't shown any desire to really go much beyond, you know, what is it, roughly maybe $100 million salary each year. So, I mean, it just wasn't going to be possible. And the fact that they were, like you said, that they were able to get a major league ready starting pitcher. I mean, frontline, I don't know. But then again, I'm just now getting into, you know, doing research, but he's definitely major league, you know, capable. So he becomes, you know, somebody that goes into the rotation. And yeah, contractually he's under the Braves control for several years, whereas Hayward, he was going to break the bank next year. I mean, that's there's no question about that.
Right. And I think that as far as the Braves were concerned, I think that probably the final nail in the coffin was in all likelihood the deal that Juan Carlos Stanton signed with the Marlins, where he signed for $325 million over 13 years, which is just a completely reckless and irresponsible thing of the Marlins to do. But as soon as they did that, they basically set the market for elite right fielders. And if you look at their numbers from 2014, I mean, obviously Stanton put up much better power numbers, but Juan Carlos Stanton had a WAR of 6.1, wins above replacement of 6.1. Jason Hayward was 5.1. I mean, if you're going to pay Juan Carlos Stanton, if you're going to say that the market for that guy is $25 million over the next 13 seasons, Jason Hayward's going to come awfully close to something like that. I mean, Hayward's definitely going to get a contract that's in the $200 million neighborhood, and that's going to be well north of 20 per season. Teams absolutely pay for WAR. I mean, whether, you know, the old school baseball people want to acknowledge that or not, that's what's going on here. And I think as soon as the ink dried on Stanton's contract, I think the Braves realized that, you know, any ideas that we had about re-signing this guy in the long term just went out the window.
To me, that contract that Stanton got isn't quite as atrocious as like Albert Pujols got, just because at least in age, Stanton won't be, he's going to see at least, I don't know, 8 or 9 years of that as like a quality, you know, starter. You know, that you're not going to have to worry about. You're not going to be looking to, you know, ship him off to the AL to be a DH type of thing. It's a shock as far as the Marlins deciding to spend money. But I guess if you're going to throw money like that, if you're going to throw $25 million a year out, I think Stanton is one of those guys that that's worth it, just because of what he can do from an offensive and defensive standpoint. And to be honest with you, I really do appreciate, you know, Hayward as a you know, as a hometown product. He's second to none as far as a defensive right fielder goes. But there have been talks, you know, recently about how he's been regressing as an offensive player. So, I mean, not to say that he was, but you just can't afford to play around when you're talking about the $20 to $25 million a season range. I mean, you cannot miss on a contract like that. I mean, we did that twice so far, and that's what I mean. It's submarine Frank Wren's ability to really do anything. I mean, when you hand out, you know, basically with Uggla and BJ's contract, I mean, that's essentially what it would amount to. I mean, it's just a ton of money that's just locked away, and you're not going to be able to move it. So, I mean, I think for me, it's the smart move, just because he's not going to be the absolute five tool kind of player that should warrant that kind of monster deal. But then again, I wonder, I mean, Freeman got a really sweet deal too. So, I mean, I think maybe Freeman is a little bit more along the lines of being worthwhile of that contract. And plus, playing first base, it's probably, you know, from a longevity standpoint, it's probably easier to pencil him in for that number of years versus, you know, an outfielder who's going to need to stay, you know, athletically viable more so than a first baseman.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I just think that, you know, given Hayward's age, I mean, he's really coming into his prime right now. And I know he hit a lot of home runs his rookie year, and, you know, especially the start that he got off to in 2010, I think he kind of caused everybody to think that he was going to be a perennial 40 home run a year guy. And, you know, the power obviously hasn't developed the way that we thought. But, you know, while he was doing that, something else developed with the guy or began to show through, and this is that he's an extremely capable leadoff hitter. And, you know, I think he really filled a void for the Braves there where that was concerned. And, he's one of these really rare guys that could hit 1, 3, or 5 for you. And, I mean, you just don't have a lot of guys out there that can do that. I mean, Freeman can't do that. Obviously just because of a lack of speed. But, I am 100,000% convinced that Jason Hayward's best days of baseball are in front of him. And I think whoever it is that ultimately locks him up to that long-term deal after next year, I think they're going to be extremely satisfied with it. I really do.
Did you know that Jason Hayward, in his first major league at-bat, hit a home run? I was watching that game. Can you name... You were watching it
go
as
ahead,
well? Can you name any of the other players that have done that as well in their first major league baseball at-bat?
Ooh, their first at-bat?
Their first at-bat.
Goodness. Jordan Schaefer homered in his first game, I remember, and that happened in 2008, I want to say. But I don't believe it was his first at-bat that he did that. I used to know the answer to this question. I think it's an all-time great, if I'm not mistaken.
The only one that comes to mind, and I know there's multiple players that have done this, but the one that I used when I asked you this question right after that Jason Hayward home run via text message, Will Clark, third baseman for the San Francisco Giants.
Yeah, there you go.
So to put things further into context, moving away from the Braves and going into the Marlins a little bit, I know we were talking about Gia's deal, and what do they call him? Stanton? Carlo?
I like
Gio as well. But Sheffield, remember when Gary Sheffield signed with the Marlins back in 94?
Mm-hmm, I did.
And that was a big, big deal to all of us as adolescents, because at the time he was the highest paid third baseman in the league, and he would have been the highest he was the highest paid player on the Marlins team. Care to take a stab at how much his 4-year deal was worth back in 1994?
Probably like $12 million or something like that.
$22.5 million, so just under $6 million.
Wow.
A year for one of the most prolific Triple Crown hitters in the league, one of the best third basemen in the league, and probably the hottest free agent bat on the market that year. $22.5 million.
I mean, could you imagine offering a contract to a guy like that? I mean, 1994 wasn't that long. It's 2 decades ago. But, I mean, can you imagine offering a contract to a guy like that that you fully expect to hit 40 home runs a year for you?
Not at all. Not at all. That's actually our next caller on the other line at the moment. I apologize. Technical difficulties. This is the first time we've ever had two guests back-to-back on the same pod, so I apologize. But to wrap that up, did you say everything you wanted to say on the Hayward piece, or should we schedule another call for the future?
Well, if I could have about 15 seconds, I have one more thing I wanted to add about him.
Go ahead.
Well, I just think that he was extremely underappreciated in Atlanta. I heard a lot of Atlanta Braves fans are really applauding the move, and I understand the financial justification for it, and it was probably in the Braves' long-term interest, but I think a lot of Braves fans felt like they were getting rid of a bad player. And I will point out that in terms of WAR, there were only two right fielders in all of Major League Baseball that had a better WAR than Jason Hayward. Those are Jose Bautista and Juan Carlos Stanton. Yasiel Puig had the same WAR in 2014 as Hayward. So if you're going to consider Bautista, Stanton, and Puig to be elite right fielders, you can't not consider Jason Hayward to be an elite right fielder.
No, and I agree.
You hate to lose guys like that.
I totally agree. I mean, I think that the financial motivation is what ultimately overruled any other any other talent evaluation there. I mean, it's definitely anyone that thinks that that Hayward was easily traded away because he wasn't something that that the Braves wanted to keep, I think they're sorely mistaken. It's just one of those situations where they had to make a move. There was no way. I mean, we'll see how long it takes to move either of the Upton brothers from their contracts. I mean, we'll see if you know, any of the other, I think those are the two only other really big contracts. One of those three guys, one of the outfielders had to go, and I think Hayward was just the easiest one to immediately go. And as you mentioned, you know, in the beginning of the segment, to get, you know, to get a starting pitcher out of the deal, and then also a decent pitching prospect as well in the deal, it was too good to pass up, given the fact that, you know, it was something that they needed, and they sure as heck, you know, couldn't have, you know, kept all those guys on contract, knowing full and well they were going to lose the guys for maybe a first round, a first round draft pick at best.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And you know, at the end of the day, Shelby Miller and Tyrell Jackson are a lot better haul than getting a compensatory first round pick, which is what would have happened if we kept Hayward in 15 and then not re-signed him. So, I think it was definitely the prudent thing for the Braves franchise to make. I'm telling you, there are a lot of Braves fans down here in Atlanta that think it was a good move because they think we got rid of an overrated player, and I don't think anything could be any farther from the truth.
Absolutely. Well, I want to go ahead and extend a FCK thank you as big as we got to you, Mr. Peacock. We sure loved having you on the podcast this evening.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. I sure did enjoy it, and you know, free to join you guys anytime. I can't really add a whole lot about NBA basketball, but you know, other topics of interest, I've got plenty to say. Obviously, so
no, we definitely appreciate it. Yeah, it's definitely appreciated, and we'll definitely look to do it again in the near future. I mean, like you said, baseball is something that's going to be on the front of our minds with the off season quickly approaching, and then it's always football season, so we can always talk about Georgia football.